Hello, STR Ask. I'm John Noyes. I'm filling in for the amazing Amy Hall. I'm just doing my best here, and I'm here in studio with Greg Kokel. How are you?
Hey, Proby.
Let's hope it goes well. we have a ton of questions, so let's just dive in. First, Nicholas Smith, he asks a really wonderful question here. Are souls created at conception?
Well, there's some debate about that. It's not my view. Well, let me back up. It is my view. Actually, now I'm thinking about it, more has to be said about this because the question is a little ambiguous. The real issue is not so much when souls are created, although that does have ramifications, I think, for some moral questions like abortion, but the manner in which souls are created. So let me just lay out the two basic positions, and then our friend can kind of answer his own question for himself, okay? The two views are that the soul is a product of the human reproductive process, all right? So souls are, God has created human beings in such a way that when they reproduce an entire human being. Okay, and that is body and soul, material and immaterial. And if the body comes into existence at conception, so does the soul, because what comes into existence is the entire human being. Okay, and that's called traducianism. And it's a view I hold because it seems to make the most sense to me.
Yeah.
It also makes sense that people beget after their own kind. And so their own kind is a human, which is a material and immaterial self, which self is fallen. And so when the human reproduces another human being who is both immaterial and material and fallen. Okay, so there's a continuity there. That makes a lot of sense to me. So that would then mean that abortion at any stage kills a full and complete human being.
That's right.
Okay, so that's one view called traducianism. The other view says that it isn't the human reproductive process that is that results in the creation of the soul, but rather it is a de novo creation of God. The soul is uniquely created for every individual by God. Okay? Now, that some people believe, I think that's a Roman Catholic view.
And they exist independent, they exist incorporeally, like without a body.
Yeah, this is another wrinkle to the question. I'm just talking now about the ontology, the nature of their existence, how they come into being. But it may be that when God creates the soul, he creates the soul at the exact same moment as he creates the body, or he may create the soul at some other time and then joins it with the body. And some people thought that this is when a mother experiences the quickening. That is the movement of the child in her womb, that is when the soul is, in a certain sense, placed in or united with the body of the unborn child. Okay? So that's a view. It's not my view. Mm-hmm. But I just want to point out that if a person who holds the traducian view, there is no discontinuity of any kind between the existence of the human body and the existence of the human soul, since the same process produces both. But on the creationist view, there could be an discontinuity. That is, it could be that God creates individually the soul and places the soul in conjunction with the body, at conception or sometime after.
Yeah.
Now, if it's sometime after, the argument goes, then abortion prior to the unification of the soul with the body would be morally acceptable. That's their view. Because what you're doing is just killing a living organism, but not an ensouled human.
Right.
And if the image of God is not in the body but is in the soul, then you're not destroying the image bearer because the body is not bearing the image at that time. So goes the argument, okay? The problem with that argument is it's based on complete ignorance.
Yeah.
First of all, the creationist view of the soul would have to be true on that argument, which I'm taking exception with that. It could be. But then you have to assume that the soul is not united with the body until some later date. And how is it that you're going to know that? There is no theological evidence for that. There's no biblical evidence for that. In fact, the biblical evidence seems to be just the contrary. Luke chapter 1, we have in the second trimester, John the Baptist leaping in his mother's womb with joy because he's in the presence of Jesus, the Messiah, the zygote. Keep in mind, by the way, and how is it, Elizabeth says, that the mother of my Lord, okay, the Lord is the second person of the Trinity, not the fetus.
Yeah.
Unless the fetus is the second person of the Trinity in virtue of having the personhood and the soul of the human being in the fetus at the point that this comment was made, which is in the earliest part of the first trimester.
Yeah.
So it strikes me that the best way to explain that is that whether creationist or traditionist view is true, that the soul and the body are together from the beginning. Okay,
yeah.
And that's why Elizabeth can say, the mother of my Lord. Mm-hmm. And then in the presence, John the Baptist, in the presence of Jesus, the incarnate Son of God, in the womb of Mary in the first trimester, really zygote stage, could be filled with the Spirit and leap with joy. Okay, so that all makes sense in light of that. So this argument in favor of abortion that, well, the soul may not be there that early, it might be some other time, turns out to be specious because even though that may be true, since it's a may not, then the ethical doubt should go towards the child,
yeah,
not against the child. So, example, John, if you had a building you were going to blow up.
Yeah.
I've never blown up a building, but people do that.
Sometimes. Sounds like it'd be fun.
And just before you kind of press the lever, somebody says, wait a minute, is there anybody in that building? And you say, I don't know. Maybe yes, maybe no. Is this an argument for blowing up the building? No, it's the opposite. It's an argument for not doing anything unless you know for sure.
Yeah.
So I think that this whole approach, and I think the question is probably couched in that larger discussion about abortion, that whole approach is misguided for a whole bunch of reasons.
Yeah, that's really interesting. My mind goes to, okay, if the soul existed, independent of conception, not at the moment of conception, has the soul always existed? Obviously not, because then it would be God, right? The only thing that exists forever is God. The soul, was it, if it was created at a previous time, where does it wait in existence?
Well, that's the Mormon view.
That is a Mormon view, yeah. And so that means it's waiting someplace in order to receive its body, which
is why Mormons have lots of kids.
And also, yes, and just doesn't seem like a biblical view. I don't think it's supported.
No, there's nothing scripturally that indicates the preexistence of the soul, although Origen, as I recall, might have believed that. Now, Origen was a significant player early on, but it doesn't mean all those players were always right, and there's no good biblical reason to believe that.
It seems to me like that belief leads to either something like Mormonism, or this is where you get the idea of like a reincarnation or something like that.
Possible.
That the soul inhabited another body,
then
another body. But the Bible's obviously clear that we're afforded one life, and then we account for our sins.
Yeah. So. Reincarnation, by the way, is just for the record, is not the LDS view, but the belief they have about the preexistence of the soul does lend itself to maybe an interpretation like that.
Yeah. So just to clearly state it, would you say that your view on this is that the soul is created and imparted to the body upon conception?
No, that's not my view, because that's a creationist view of the soul. I am a traducian, and so I believe that the soul is there at conception, but through a different means. The body and soul are the product of the standard process of recreation of human beings between a mother and a father.
Awesome. Perfect. Thank you for clarifying that. That's good. So now we have Flyboy has sent us this question. You know what? I'm going to go one up because Clausen, S. Clausen. What do the scriptures teach about the immortality of the soul? We'll stay with the soul.
Yeah, well, this is an interesting question, but there's an ambiguity here, and that has to do with immortality of the soul. There's lots of ways that confusion can present itself in discussions between different types of views. And I think ambiguity, or what would we call equivocation, does cause confusion, especially in the discussion about the nature of hell. Okay. Immortality could be native or it could be given. All right. The idea that souls are immortal in themselves, that would be what I'm calling a native immortality, that the nature of souls is to exist forever. That notion, I don't have any reason to believe that that's the case. Some have said, well, see, that's a Greek notion of the immortality of the soul. Well, it may be. That doesn't mean it's false because it's Greek, but I don't know that that's what the scripture requires. However, people who do not believe in the eternal hell, Christians who do not believe in eternal hell, will argue that that requires the immortality of the soul, and souls are not immortal in the native sense, is the way they're arguing. The native immortality of the inherent immortality of the soul is a Greek concept that's imported into Christianity. Well, I believe in everlasting souls, but I don't think that that's necessarily because they were made everlasting, or that the nature of being a soul is to be immortal or to live forever. It might be, I don't know. But it could be that the immortality is given to the person, if immortality means you never go out of existence. And so I don't have to say I believe in the immortality of the soul in the first sense. I could just simply say God sustains the soul forever. Wherever it happens to be, God's responsible for that, not because of any inherent quality of the soul. So it strikes me that my view of eternal hell as a place of conscious punishment is not compromised by the complaint, well, that means you believe in the immortality of the soul, meaning in the first sense.
Yeah.
I don't mean it in the first sense. It doesn't matter to me. It could the second sense does just fine, that God himself sustains the existence of the souls forever and ever, which is the language that is used of the punishment in the place of fire in the book of Revelation. And actually, I think certainly chapter 20, and I think chapter 14 makes reference to it as well. So anyway, I do believe in the immortality of the soul in the sense that the human souls, both of the lost and the saved, exist forever. There's a resurrection of everyone, and those people never go out of existence. That's my view. But whether or not that's because the souls are inherently immortal or they are sustained by God forever is another question. And I don't have to answer that, frankly. It could be either one. And if people find fault with the first, there's no way you can find fault with the second, because certainly that's possible for God to do. The question is a biblical one. What does the text say about what happens to people in the end? And Tim Barnett and I have written a three-part series on that called Hell Interrupted, that folks can find on our website. We did two of the series back-to-back in our Solid Ground, and then we waited about a year and a half to finally close the circle. But those are all available at str.org, and we do go into those details, those issues in some detail.
Yeah, I feel like we don't talk about the soul enough, especially you know, one of the things when I was, one of the things that I was wrestling with, and as an atheist coming to Christianity, was actually the existence of the soul. You, the way you put it in your presentations and stuff, is the bump of me when you're bumping into that reality. And even the objection when people are asking this stuff, I'm wondering if you're, I always picture people raising these types of objections, speaking to their unbelieving friends, maybe just because of my context, but
being a former atheist.
And in that conversation, when somebody brings up, well, what about the soul? I'll ask them, well, what about the soul?
What about it? Right.
You know, cause like, let's talk about that. And how's that fit into your story? And does it have a place, the existence of an immaterial
thing?
The
irony is the people who deny the existence of the soul, and those people are legion, is that the soul is the thing that they're probably most directly in touch with for their entire lives.
Every second of every day, for the most part.
Certainly their waking lives, and even their non-waking lives. I had some disturbing dreams last night, but those things are all soulish activity, you know. Even though C fibers were firing in my brain, there was a lot of brain activity, that what I was seeing and experiencing was not C fibers firing. I saw images, there was a story playing itself out, there were things that troubled me, okay? And those were my dreams. Those were features of my conscious life that were somewhere else other than my brain.
That's right. And now you need to, where were they? Mm-hmm. You know, it's the question. But that's fantastic. I wish we could spend more time on the soul. I wish we just had more about the soul.
J.P. Moreland has done some really good work on this, and I'm a student of his. He's had a tremendous impact on my life. And in fact, I got an email from him this morning. And it was a really sweet little conversation back and forth. But he's one of the most powerful influences on my life as a Christian thinker. And he's done lots and lots of work on this issue. So anybody wants to get more detail on arguments for the soul, just turn to J.P. Moreland.
Yeah, he knows his stuff. So we have a question from Flyboy here. And he says, I've heard and agree with your explanation of how the Mosaic Law was written for the people of Israel and do not for today's Christians. How do you feel about Christians who, in quotes, idolize the Ten Commandments? And he gives an example. For example, the Alabama judge who fought to have a display in his courtroom, or people displaying stone replicas and things of that kind.
Well, I wouldn't call that idolizing it, personally. I think that's maybe the wrong language to use. And I think nine of the Ten Commandments are applicable to us as moral obligations, because they represent universals that found their way into the Mosaic Law because of their universal quality. So we are not beholden to the Ten Commandments because they're in the Mosaic Law. We're beholden to all but, I think, the Sabbath, that would be my view, because it seems to be accepted as it's no longer required, based on New Testament texts. But all the rest of the things are clearly on reflection alone, never mind the fact that they're repeated in the New Testament, are the kinds of things that transcend any local system of laws. That we should not murder, for example, this is clear in Genesis chapter 6. This is right from the beginning. So, it actually goes earlier than that with Cain and Abel, where you have a murder that's clearly characterized as immoral. So these are the kinds of things that should show up in any system of laws, and that's why they show up in the Ten Commandments. I am obliged not to murder, not because of what the Ten Commandments say, but because regardless of that Ten Commandments, it's still wrong for me to do it. It's just recorded there in the Ten Commandments. So for the judge, though, to make an issue about it the way he did, I don't think that's idolatry, but what I think it is an attempt, whether it's well-guided or not, it was an attempt to hold our communities accountable to a standard of objective right and wrong. And that's what this does. Now, of course, the Ten Commandments and the entire Mosaic Law was a law incumbent on all the people of Israel, and that whole law is not incumbent upon everybody else, obviously. But I think there are things in there that are transcended, as I mentioned, not just in the Ten Commandments, but beyond that. But I think the idea of trying to emphasize a standard of justice and goodness that we judge people by and we are held accountable by is a good one. So whether his specific attempts were ill-advised or not, that's another matter. You have to look more closely at it. And sometimes when we make a big fuss about these things, it does more harm than good.
Yeah.
But in terms of the idea, I think if you want to put the Ten Commandments there, you should be allowed to. It's in the Supreme Court, for goodness sake. You got Moses up there, etched into stone with the tablets. What do they do, put an American flag over that thing or something so people don't see it? I don't think this is a meaningful violation of the First Amendment. And I think it is a good reminder that we are beholden, that we are a nation under God, just like every nation is. And virtually every president understood us to be until most recent times.
Yeah, I think that's a key, is the reminder aspect. You know, so there's something in stone, literally in stone, that you can look to, that in a way that stone monument prevents us from slipping into relativism.
Right.
So I think it's
there
a good
thing.
There
is a law above the law,
that's
is
right.
The point.
Yeah.
Our laws are beholden to the greater law.
Amen. That's good. That's really good. And with that, we're going to end this session of STR Ask. And if you have questions for us, you can always submit them via Twitter, hashtag STR Ask, and we would love to answer them. This is John Noyes with Greg Kokel for Stand to Reason.